You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Paula Sophia Schonauer is a licensed clinical social worker, adjunct professor at the University of Oklahoma, and advocate for the transgender community. He retired from the Oklahoma City Police Department after 22 years of service, where she was the first openly transgender officer with the department. Paula is a community advocate and educator for transgender people. For this work, she received the Hero of Hope Award from an Oklahoma City metropolitan area church that recognizes someone who's taken a stand for the rights of the LGBTQ community. She also is a therapist and case manager for the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. In 2014, Paula was a candidate for Oklahoma House District 88, which she lost by a mere 20 votes. She also served in the United States Army, reaching the rank of captain. Paula holds multiple degrees: a Master of Social Work from the University of Oklahoma, a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing and Contemporary Literature from the University of Central Oklahoma, and a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology and Criminal Justice from Southwestern Oklahoma State University. Paula, first of all, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome.
Welcome, Paula. And I wanted to tell our listeners how we came to know you. So, listeners, I heard Paula speak at a panel discussion on trans progress in Oklahoma in November of 2021. It was at the University of Oklahoma. It was primarily concerned with the legislative progress in the state, and the panelists were made up of state and community leaders who support and advocate for trans rights. And Paula was an invited panelist. A side note, this event was personally important to me because our elder son transed his gender in 2020. And I feel like it's my responsibility as his mother to learn as much as I can on topics that impact him. And what I've come to understand in a more personal way is that it's hard to be trans in Oklahoma. And one of the things that I learned at the panel was about the Oklahoma House passing Senate Bill 2 in April, which is an anti-transgender bill that bans transgender girls and women from participating in sports at the elementary, secondary, and post-secondary level in Oklahoma, which August had told me about. But hearing the panel discuss that in more detail was really helpful. And then a week after that, the lawmaker who helped revive that bill wrote in an email that transgender people have a mental illness. So that's just one example from the panel. It's also kind of the water that we swim in around here. I was telling Deborah about this, Paula, but just for the listeners and for you as well, I got this mailer, which I'm showing. I can see Paula and Deborah, but I got a mailer in the mail this past week. And it's not uncommon. I tend to get these mailers. It's titled God's Eternal Truths in Changing Times, and it's put out by the Christian Citizens for Truth in Norman. And it's pretty typical. It covers the marriage and family stuff and abortion stuff and, you know, socialism and things like that. But for the marriage and family section, it's talking about how God created man in his image. And then it further went on to clarify that a boy cannot become a girl and a girl cannot become a boy. And being raised Southern Baptist, I heard that, you know, pretty often. But Paula being trans and her knowledge of kind of legislative progress for trans people in Oklahoma is not the reasons that we invited her to be on the panel today, I mean, on the pod today. While she and some of the other panelists were introducing themselves at that panel discussion last November, she happened to mention that she used to be a deacon in the Episcopal Church and that she stepped down whenever there was pressure brought to bear by the community when she started living as a woman, kind of living out loud as a woman. And then I could barely wait to get to her after the panel to ask for her contact information to learn, you know, I was just desperate to get you on the podcast so we could just hear more of your story. In fact, I called Deborah the next morning, Paula, and I said, well, I couldn't have been more awkward. I didn't even tell her my name. I just came up and asked for contact info. I could have been any loony, but she gave me her contact info. And so we're just very, very excited to have you on the podcast and to hear more about your transformation story and how your experiences kind of have shaped what you're doing now. So that is a long lead up. I don't normally do a kind of a long meandering lead up like that. So did I get any of that wrong, or is that pretty?
No, it's accurate.
Okay. So I guess I'm not sure where to start. I'm wondering, my first question would be, did you grow up in the context of church? Have you always been Episcopal?
No, I started going to the Episcopal Church when I was in my undergrad college and at Southwestern Oklahoma State University during the 1980s. I went to the Canterbury Club, which is the student Episcopal Church Club. And then later on, I ended up joining the Episcopal Church. And then a few years later, I started the process of seeking holy orders, and then was eventually ordained a vocational deacon in 1999.
I'm wondering if you grew up in a church other than the Episcopal one, or did you grow up without any church involvement at all?
Well, I did go to a church for many years when I was a child. I went to a Missouri Synod Lutheran Church school. So this is, you know, 1972, 73, desegregation and busing was the big thing. And my parents pulled me out of public school and put me into the parochial schools, of which Redeemer Christian School is what it was called, but it was part of a Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. And it's a Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. And so they're very conservative. They were part, you know, they joined the Moral Majority with Jerry Falwell during the late 1970s, early 1980s, the example of their flavor of their theology.
I know that flavor very well, raised as a Southern Baptist in Oklahoma. So did you feel that you were different from the church's teachings?
Yeah, from the very beginning, when I was going to that school. Now, my dad tells this story, and it seems like it's true. He's not a Christian, but and then he and my mom went to talk to the pastor of the school, of the church, and to about enrolling me in the school, and then subsequently my brother and sister when they came of age, and because I'm the oldest, and the pastor was concerned that my father didn't subscribe to the Christian religion. And then he said, well, I want to I want to give your children a chance to be a Christian. So, you know, he decided to let us go to the school without charge.
Oh, okay.
As long as my family joined the church. And so one of the things that they did every Monday morning was they took church and Sunday school attendance. And because my parents weren't really avid Christians and church-going Christians, my mom called herself a Christian, but she wasn't avid about church, going to church. I would say, not present, not present. And I would keep getting these looks from the teachers like, oh, goodness, you know, like I was just extra baggage. And the church in the school was really full because of the busing situation, I think. So But I was still, I was able to continue going to the school through eighth grade. And then I went to Walsh Jesuit High School after that.
Oh, okay.
The Jesuits, a whole lot different than Missouri Synod Lutherans.
That was going to be my next question. So, because I would expect that too. How and in what ways were they, was it different?
Well, for example, the Missouri Synod Lutherans, a lot of times the way that they approach the Bible, the way that they approach Christianity, you know, it's very conservative, fundamentalist, you know, Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God, you know, that kind of idea, and very staid and stoic and I guess self-righteous. It was a vibe I got. When I went to Walsh Jesuit High School, I found the brothers and the priests there remarkable. They were a lot more laid back. They were a lot more real. We would actually, in our theology class that we had to take, Father O'Reilly, he would actually, you know, let us ask questions. And then at the Redeemer Christian School, we couldn't really ask questions. That unless they were, that the answers follow the line that they're trying to teach us. I remember asking a lot of questions in my theology class, and I remember Father O'Reilly pulled me out of class and asked me to consider joining the order.
Ah, is that where you first got the idea for ordination?
No, I actually, so part of our education at Redeemer is, you know, we had this starting in fifth grade and then through sixth grade, because in fifth grade we did the Old Testament, and then on the sixth grade we did the New Testament, was the Hurlburt story of the Bible, and which for me was wonderful. I really liked reading the stories of the Bible. They were more mature than like the Bible story books that you get in doctor's offices. You know, and then they had this ruler that came with it, and we had to read the stories and then use our workbooks to identify things like, you know, examples of repentance, examples of prophecy, examples of divine intervention. So those kinds of things. And I just ate it up and I really absorbed the stories. And then I would go to my Bible that I got at the same time I got the story of the Bible from Herbert's, and I would go back and forth and compare and contrast how the words. So I really studied it, even outside of school. So by the time I got to seventh grade, that was the year that we started our confirmation classes in our religion. I knew these stories of the Bible, and our pastor that was teaching the confirmation classes once asked this story about Jephthah in the book of Judges and how he promises to sacrifice the first thing that comes out to greet him when he comes back victorious from a battle, and it's his daughter, and he sacrifices his daughter. And it disturbed me greatly, because why did God intervene for Isaac, but not Jephthah's daughter, who's not even named in the scripture? She's named in the Talmud, but not in the book of Judges. And it just bothered me. I was becoming aware of my struggle with gender identity at that time, and I was becoming aware of how unfair the Bible seemed to be to women, and that story really stuck out to me as totally unfair. Why didn't God save the girl? You know, in other words. And so when I go into seventh grade, you know, the very first class, our pastor, Pastor Don, was, you know, kind of quizzing us orally about our knowledge of the Bible. And a lot of us students, I mean, we're getting a lot of the answers right. So he goes, "But I bet you all don't know who Jephthah was." So I raised my hand. And I remembered that because it really bothered me. And I answered the question, and he kept asking other questions, and I kept raising my hand. And then next thing I know, the head pastor, when I originally started going to the school, pulls me in his office and he starts talking to me about it. And all of a sudden, for the first time going to that school after 5-6 years, I felt like a valuable student. Like, okay, this little street urchin, you know, kind of like charity case kid is really absorbing this stuff. And I got a real, I wrote two of them and they picked the one that they wanted, like a little speech to give at our confirmation class. And all of the students had the right one, but only some of the students got chose to share. And I was one of the ones that was chosen to share. And I really, that's when I felt the stirrings of being called to ministries. So I was 13.
That's young, but not uncommon.
I was just going to point out, Paula, that when you talk about being able to ask questions and question your religion, all of that, it's something that Robin was not able to experience. She had to just be in lockstep with everything that she was told. So I'm really happy to hear that you had a completely different experience.
Yeah, with the Jesuits, they were, you know, I was raised very blue collar, you know, maybe a high school diploma, not always in my family. And so when I went to Walsh Jesuit High School, these were the most learned people I've ever been around. And not all of the teachers there were men. Some of the, you know, there were some women who were teachers there too. They weren't part of the Jesuit order, but, you know, like, and then Father Kappas, who was the principal, he had a PhD and he also had a law degree. And Father O'Reilly himself, you know, he had his, you know, a PhD in divinity. And then he also had a PhD in medical, like biosciences. And so these guys, you know, I noticed that they were all these men were constantly in the process of educating themselves and then educating others, which is the essential mission of the Jesuit order. And so I was really, really impressed with the way they approached religion. And then Father O'Reilly, you know, he made Christ, you know, Jesus Christ seem human and not this Lamb of God, you know, kind of, you know, like the different depictions of Jesus in the Gospels. You know, you could tell the real difference between the synoptic Gospels, you know, in Matthew and Mark, his last words are, "Why have you forsaken me?" A very human thing, you know. And then in Luke, the "Into thy hands I commend my spirit." And then at the end of John, "It is finished." You know, you know, that kind of, "All right, I've done this dirty work. Thank goodness it's done." You know, is the sometimes the way I see that those last words. And That's the kind of Jesus that Redeemer Christian School had. The Jesuits were more human. You know, they depict, Father O'Reilly talked about, you know, he asked me one time, "What would Jesus be like playing football?"
Mm-hmm. I love those kinds of questions.
And I have to say, Father O'Reilly is like, you know, he used to be part of the faculty at Notre Dame University at the time. I'm sure Father O'Reilly is not with us anymore. He was already pretty advanced in age when I was there, you know, 40 plus years ago now. But he's a huge football fan and so a lot of football metaphors in his class. So he told the story about, "What do you think Jesus, you know, he's a lineman. You know why he's a lineman? Because he supports everybody. That's why, you know." And then he said, "And then if when the ball's high, do you think he's going to go, 'Ooh, I'm Jesus. I'm gentle, meek, and mild. Ooh, I'm going to get out of your way.' No, he's going to knock the guy on his ass. And then when the whistle blows, give his hand and pull him back, you know, help him to his feet." And that was, you know, in where I'd been previously, that would have been kind of sacrilegious to depict Jesus like that.
You can't make jokes about Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, it seemed like that. Very stern, serious, stoic. And then the Jesuits, you know, and I know Catholic Church has plenty of that too.
Yeah.
But Jesuits were so refreshing to me. And I didn't at that time, that it was not a co-ed school. It is now. So it was all boys school back then. And I didn't like that. But overall, though, the education experience was very dynamic compared to public schools. And I was really flattered to be joined, you know, to be offered to join the Jesuit order. And I'm happy to say that nothing weird ever happened with the priests and the brothers there as far as any sexual innuendo or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it sounds like they also were open to your questions around gender. Did you ever get to ask that question about the daughter?
I didn't get to ask the Jesuits about that. I did ask questions about in class about, you know, why, you know, about different things. I'm trying to think of specifically this one question that I did ask. This was over 40 years ago, but we were having a discussion about, you know, whether Jesus was divine or human, and it was centered around that. And then, you know, Father O'Reilly was polling the class. So how many think he was divine, more divine than human? Just about all the class raised their hands. And then I raised my hand. I guess I was the contrarian there. And I said, I thought he was more human than divine.
That's where I land now.
And he asked me to explain myself. And I said, well, you know, I mean, I can't imagine if he was a person, if he didn't feel hungry, you know, those kinds of things. And I don't know. I don't know why I had this sense. I could identify with a more human Jesus. The divine Jesus was judgmental and stern and stoic. And I didn't have a chance with him. But, you know, my gender identity issue was very strong at that point. And I knew I was going to go to hell if Jesus was all divine, but the human Jesus seemed approachable to me. I couldn't articulate that back then, but that was really part of the attraction to a human Jesus.
Well, that is one of the things I was going to ask you about. One of the articles that we read in prep for the interview was actually one in the Arizona Daily Sun. And it's when you gave up your assignment after, you know, like fully living as a woman. But one of the things that they mention, or that you are quoted as saying, is that you really struggled with, you know, is this a sin? And you got some good counsel from Bishop Moody on that. Now I can't find it. I know I highlighted that, but you got some good counsel from Bishop Moody on that, which I would love for you to comment on. But I was just curious, before maybe you comment on that, when did you join the Episcopal Church, and why the Episcopal Church?
Well, I joined the Episcopal Church in 1988, you know, while I was attending Canterbury Club.
Oh, okay. That's right. Canterbury Club. Yep. Yeah. I did too. That's Paula. So for me, I had no idea about the Episcopal Church because, of course, I didn't growing up. I barely even understood Catholic. Yeah. So the Episcopal Church was the first time I ever heard anybody say no two people think alike, like no two Episcopalians think alike, which I had never, ever heard in my whole life. So yeah, yay for Campus Canterbury's.
Yes. The Father Joe Zeppele was the priest at what had been St. Mark's in Weatherford, Oklahoma, and also St. Paul's in Clinton. And I just began talking with him, and we became friends. And then I would be able to ask him questions, you know, explore not only my faith, but also my doubt.
Oh, yes. Your doubt.
Yeah.
Well, I had so much of that. And whenever I would voice any of that, I'd get put on the Wednesday night prayer list, but that wasn't really a good thing.
Yeah. And then I also met my first wife at Canterbury Club. And then so we ended up joining the Episcopal Church together after we graduated. And then we moved to Dallas and we actually got confirmed in the Episcopal Church at St. Matthew's Cathedral in Dallas. So
that's great. What was the process for you becoming a deacon in the Episcopal Church. I was just wondering, like, what finally caused you to pursue that path? And then what, because I was telling Deborah, there's quite a bit of difference between, you know, becoming a deacon in the church that I grew up in and becoming a deacon in the Episcopal Church.
Yeah. The vocational deacons in the Episcopal Church, you know, they're ideally, they're fully equal holy orders to a priest, but just different ministries, depending on the diocese and how the bishop's attitude about deacons. But that was Bishop Moody's attitude. He was trying to develop the vocational diaconate when I was coming into the program. But after I had that initial call when I was 13 and then went to Walsh Jesuit High School, and Father O'Reilly invited me to join the order, and my father was against that. He was always afraid that I would be queer. And he said that if you join a Catholic order, you'll definitely become a queer. And I'm like, okay, yeah. And then another thing that he didn't like about clergy is that they have soft hands, is what he said.
Oh, no.
Well, that's a blue collar type comment, right?
Exactly. He's blue collar. And so then when he got transferred by General Motors to Oklahoma City, that's how we got here.
Ah, General Motors. Okay.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Ohio?
Akron, Ohio. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And then I encountered a church here in Oklahoma, you know, like that really appalled me, honestly. So my first day, you know, back then in the early 80s, 1981, Choctaw was out in the country. It wasn't as suburban as it is now. And I went to Choctaw High School, and it was it looked very similar to the high school in Footloose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember the very first day of school, after we were leaving the last class, there are these guys right off of campus that were handing out white supremacist literature to especially targeting young men. And I was like, what the heck? And then a neighbor who was a year ahead of me in school, I was a sophomore then, she was a junior, invited me to a youth thing at her church in Nakoma Park. And when I went with her to that, they burned records.
This is not unfamiliar to me, because yeah. I grew up during the whole satanic panic where they were, you know, burning records and certain books, and very Footloose, right?
Yeah. And now, one of the things that I learned a lot about at Walsh Jesuit High School was the Holocaust. We studied the Holocaust. And our history teacher showed us some of the footage of the Holocaust camps, and I was appalled. And we talked a lot about Kristallnacht and stuff. So when within the first week I'm in Oklahoma, I'm offered white supremacist literature, and go to a church that has a record burning. And I'm like, what is this place? And I'm like, I really ignored my call to ministry after that. The call got revived. It was basically a foxhole prayer in Desert Storm the night before the ground war began. I said, okay, God, I'll do this thing if you get me through this, you know. So I got through it. And, you know, because, you know, we had this very sobering, you know, we're going up against the fourth largest army in the world, and many of them are battle hardened, and we were going up against one of the Republican Guard divisions, and we were told that we can expect, you know, for a company sized element, so that's about anywhere from 120 to 180 personnel, that six of us would be killed in combat. And so we're getting ready to cross the line in the night before. And I prayed, okay, God, if I get through this, I will go ahead and pursue my call. And once I got out of there and I started going to my pastor at St. Thomas Episcopal Church at Columbus, Georgia, Father Charlie, and he was excited and they were really wanting to promote me. And I was getting ready to attend Emory University in Atlanta. But then I was getting ready to leave the Army and my wife wanted to come back to Oklahoma. So we moved back to Oklahoma. And then after we found a church and I got established there, then I started my pursuit of ministry in 1994, got accepted into the ministry exploration process. And then I went through what they call the Bishop's Advisory Committee on Ministry. And by then it was solidifying that my calling was to be a minister in the world, to bring the church to the world and the world to the church. And that appealed to me. I was a police officer at the time, and I didn't really want to give up being a police officer because I really loved it at that point. The way that I approached it, I was working a lot with the Asian community here in Oklahoma City, and I volunteered at the refugee center, and I helped teach ESL classes, and then I taught a civics class and helped the refugees study for their naturalization tests and stuff like that. So I did that for 6 years, and so I really felt called to the dispossessed. You know, I was dispossessed. I felt like a refugee myself. And for the first time, I was honest about my gender identity issues. And when I went down to Arlington, Texas to take my vocational exam, you know, to see if I'm vocationally aligned with being a pastor, I was honest about that one question in the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory about, are you happy being a girl? Or if you were born a boy, do you feel like you should have been a girl? And I said yes. And then that, you know, I got a lot of extra time with the vocational counselors now about that, my affirmative answer to that question. And then that became some discussion during my ministry exploration process off on the side. But it didn't seem to be an impediment. And I thought, okay, I was honest and they're letting me move on. So this really is God's will. And then I went through the process, but the more acquainted I became with the idea of being a minister as like being a presence. Okay. So I think the people who are the most powerful ministers are the people who have presence, and it's not anything that they have to say. It's what they do, kind of like St. Francis, you know, preach the gospel constantly and sometimes, speak, paraphrasing. And that was really, that was really something that I wanted to embody. When I preached, I wanted to not be in the pulpit. I wanted to be among the people. And I was even taking storytelling lessons so that I can unchain myself from text and tell the stories, you know, and make them vibrant and like that, and, you know, a different experience. I mean, some sermons or homilies ought to be preached from the pulpit because that's the proper place. But there's others that, you know, as far as like being among the people on the same level with the people, I felt called to be like that.
Servanthood.
Yeah, servant ministry, yeah. Which is diaconate ministry defined, is servant ministry. Mm-hmm. And so I really felt strongly about that. And that's why, I chose the vocational diaconate instead of the priesthood. And it was going really well at first. I mean, people really, really loved me, but I was vexed by this idea of the presence. And to be a presence, you have to be authentic. And I wasn't being authentic. And so near the end of my ministry formation process, I came out to my little study group about my gender identity issues, not announcing that I was going to transition or anything, but that I did struggle with that. And then a couple of people broke confidentiality and told their pastors, and it started a big controversy, and I had to be evaluated by a psychiatrist to make sure I wasn't a sexual predator. So I had to be tested on all the known paraphilias, okay? It asked questions about, you know, am I attracted to dead bodies? Am I attracted, whatever, all the little children, et cetera, and monitored to see how I'm responding. And then my wife had to be brought in and questioned about my sexual habits and blah, 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 blah.
So your life was an open book at that point.
Not totally, but the psychiatrist concluded that I was not a sexual threat, that I was not a predator. So we had this meeting with my sponsoring priest at the parish where I was going to be assigned once I got ordained, and Bishop Moody. And I promised both of them that I would live with my gender identity issue like it was a thorn in the flesh.
What do you mean by that?
Like what St. Paul says, you know, in Corinthians, you know, that which I wonder if was struggling with his sexuality when, you know, he's talking about how I want to do what I don't want to do, and all that I can't remember exactly the scripture off the top of my head, but you know, but that real struggle of trying to be faithful but struggling against sin. And you know, in Corinthians is a lot about sexual sin, so there's that context, and I really identified with that, and I completely, you know, was sincere when I answered that question. But once then I was ordained after I went through canonical exams and stuff. And I didn't last 2 years before I had a crisis, because I had cemented myself into this prison, I guess, I was a police officer. I was an ordained minister. I was a father and had two children. You know, I had this life that was, you know, very masculine, patriarchal, and to come out to talk about my truth at all, it was risking it, all of it. And it did happen. I couldn't deal with it. And so I finally told the truth. I started seeking out support, and I went to this one meeting of which I was hoping it would be more supportive, but it was more of a social group. And I dressed as a woman for that meeting. And during that meeting, I was told that there was another cop from Southern Oklahoma who was either trans or a crossdresser who wanted to meet me, but they couldn't be there at the meeting that they wanted to meet me at this one club called the Hilo Club on 50th Street in Oklahoma City. And so I really wanted to find someone who I could connect to and relate with. But when I went to go meet that person was dressed really glamorously and more oriented to being a crossdresser and hanging out in the club. And then one of my parishioners walked in the club with someone who was also a crossdresser, who later I learned was a swinger.
Oh, my goodness.
And she saw me, and then it really disturbed her, and she told the priest about me, and then everything got out. And so
you were outed. You were basically outed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
I was trusting some people that I shouldn't have trusted, because I was so lonely.
Yeah.
My wife knew about my gender identity struggle, and she supported me and stuff like that. But after it got to a certain point, she couldn't stay married with me, but we still have a friendship.
Yeah, we read that in the article in the what was it, the Arizona Daily Sun. I found that so heartening that she was one of your biggest supporters. Oh, Deborah wants to get in with a question. I can tell.
Just with a point of clarity, that's where we saw the story. But if my recollection is correct, it's an Associated Press story.
Oh,
I was a national news story for a while, right before, you know, right around 9/11, 9/11 eclipsed me though, but that, as it should have. But the story went, you know, September of 2001, and it was printed numerous times throughout the next year.
Ah, okay.
And so all over the country, and I got calls to be on all kinds of TV shows and stuff like that, which I turned down because I just didn't, you know, I was just appalled by all the attention at that point.
You weren't ready.
That was my nightmare come true, honestly. Yeah. Later on I decided, well, I'll embrace it. My confidentiality was blown. You know, I stumbled and outed myself, but some of the clergy in the Episcopal Diocese of Oklahoma made sure that it became a big controversy and got big news attention.
Oh boy. And were they some of the biggest, the strongest critics, the clergy?
Yeah, one of them was the pastor at the parish where I was.
Oh.
You know, he anonymously contacted a reporter who used the byline David Virtue, not the same as Dick Virtue in Norman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't his real name. David Virtue was kind of a gadfly, a very conservative voice in the Episcopal Church and the Anglican movement at the time. And I knew it was him because when David contacted me and was talking to me on the phone, he told me that you promised to live with this as a thorn in your flesh.
Oh, boy.
And I went, oh, well, there's only two other people that knew that I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Bishop Moody, and that was the priest at my parish. And that really hurt. I mean, that because the priest at my parish, I had told him about my gender identity conflict and my fears about things, about this being known to the whole world. I mean, I had nightmares about that from the time I was a child all the way through my adulthood up to the point where I was coming out. And so when David Virtue asked me that question, I knew it was him.
How would you characterize how you dealt with that pretty much overnight? I don't even know what to call it. Publicity. Firestorm's a great word.
Yeah, I mean, it was a firestorm. I got called from reporters and talk show hosts, Ricky Lake among them.
Oh, boy.
Mari Povich, Ananda Lewis. She had a talk show back then. She started out at MTV. And I turned them down because their platforms were ridiculous. Mm-hmm. They're not going to honor me. They're not going to honor me with any kind of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
It would, you know, and look at their shows. It was all exploitive.
Right.
But you did talk to some media, clearly.
Yeah, later on, because I wanted to be proactive about talking about setting the truth. Because some of the stories about me, especially even touted in the, even going through some of the clergy in the Episcopal Diocese of Oklahoma, were really awful. I mean, okay, so I went to go meet that person who was supposed to have been a police officer in Southern Oklahoma. And maybe that person was, but that we never connected on that. Because when my parishioner walked into the bar, I went, oh my God, I couldn't talk. And I got out as soon as I could. Now I was dressed a lot different than them. In fact, when I went to this group that earlier that night, they said, are you really a cross dresser? And I'm like, at that time I wanted to be, because that way I thought I could compartmentalize my life, you know? And they said, well, you look like you're dressed to be a real woman. Are you sure you're not transgender? And that wasn't necessarily a good thing to be in that group. Because in this, this is bizarre, but I'm dressed in a blouse and a jumper and a wig and stuff. And the other people in that group that particular night were, you know, dressed in cocktail dresses and stuff that is normally associated with sex workers. And one person was dressed as a Southern Belle, very iconic, very kind of
feminine.
very feminine, mm-hmm. but also kind of maybe even fetish kind of approach. And so I was like immediately out of place. And then when I walked into the bar, the other two people that were there, they were dressed like that too. And I just didn't connect.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you went there to try to find space to fit in, and then you didn't fit in.
No, I didn't. Not with that particular group. I did find other people who were like-minded. I just started off in the wrong group. And it got me in trouble real quick.
Did it cause a crisis of faith?
Oh, yeah. So Bishop Moody was initially very supportive. So when I realized that I couldn't, and this was even before that night that I was outed, I went to Bishop Moody and I told him, I don't think I can live up to my promise. And I offered him my resignation, my renunciation of my holy orders. And he said, he refused it. He said that I think that you have gifts for ministry, and I want you to, give yourself some time to work through your crisis, and then let's revisit this. And so,
how much time passed between that conversation with him and what ultimately happened?
It was about a week.
Oh, wow. That was fast.
And so I didn't take his support as permission. I actually dressed as a woman to go to that meeting because ironically, I was pretty visible as a police officer. I'd had media attention for some stuff that I had been doing, and I didn't want to be recognized. So I dressed as Paula to hide. Mm.
So, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? It's that dynamic because I didn't want to be seen going into my homophobia and my, was big. I didn't want to be seen as Paul going into a place normally associated with the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so you went in as Paula.
I went in as Paula. That was why I dressed that night. Mm-hmm. I just was so desperate to meet other people like me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I had been associating with some of those people already on my own. But when I, like I said, that my downfall was trying to go meet someone who was a lot like myself, as who was supposed to have been a police officer and an officer in the National Guard, Oklahoma National Guard, like I was at the time. Then, I don't know, the crisis of faith came when, after Bishop Moody was initially supportive and I offered to go on a leave from active ordained ministry. And then Bishop Moody asked me not to wear my clergy collar. He told me he didn't want me to participate in anything liturgical, even as a lay minister. He didn't want me to represent myself as clergy while I was going through this. And I said, okay, I can do that. The thing is, though, I went, I got through the next year. I got through the next year after that and completed my transition. As far as my crisis was going, it was settling down. I was still required to attend clergy conferences. And every time that I went to a clergy conference, there was a new story written by David Virtue.
Conveniently before you go. Yeah.
And so that told me that, one of the stories talked about how Paula, nay Paul,
at
a clergy conference. And so I knew that clergy were leaking these stories about me, because one of the people that was at that bar that night turned out to be a swinger and who was dressing as a woman to pick up men and stuff like that. I was associated with doing that.
Oh, but whenever you were saying that that you went there because you wanted to find somebody that you could relate to, it made me remember something that you said and one of the other panelists said at that panel discussion on the OU campus. You said, if I can't see me, I can't be me. And then I think that the other person, it may have been Val, said, if I can't see me, I can't have hope, or, other way around. Mm-hmm. I thought that was so powerful because, where do you go to be seen and affirmed and, loved? And, if you're asked to check a significant part of you at the door, that's really damaging to your spiritual self, right?
Yeah. I didn't know how to honor this. A priest who did offer to help me do like a renaming ritual, but she got in real big trouble over that.
Is that the one where everybody got together to do a service for you? Was that the naming ritual?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really lovely too, but she got in trouble.
She got in big trouble.
Has the Episcopal Church made progress in this area? Do you know?
Yeah.
I mean, are you still Episcopal?
No.
Okay.
No. In 2003, so this was, you know, 2 years after I came out and was living publicly as Paula, then the at the national convention, they voted to affirm Gene Robinson as the Bishop of New Hampshire, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. I do actually remember that.
For our listeners, can you tell us what that was about? I don't remember, nor do I know. So
yeah, Bishop Robinson was the first openly gay man to be elevated to the office of bishop in the Episcopal Church, possibly in the first out gay man to be elevated to bishop in the Anglican Communion. And then David Virtue said that I was the first out transsexual deacon in the Anglican Communion. I don't know if that's true. Don't know at all if that's true, but you know, he named me that. I don't think it was true, but anyway. But Gene Robinson was definitely the first, and he, you know, and Bishop Moody voted to affirm his elevation to the office of bishop. And the backlash that he received in the Diocese of Oklahoma was intense. The parish that I had belonged to and was serving demanded his resignation, and then ultimately left the Episcopal Church and aligned themselves with one of the Anglican primates from South America. And they started an Anglican parish that's on Southwest 104th. And so the vitriol in my parish was awful. The priest who outed me to the media, he ended up going to Colorado, and then ultimately he left the Episcopal Church and started an Anglican church in Colorado somewhere. And he's part of this 1787 project.
Oh, yeah.
Which is interesting to me. You heard of the 1787 mm-hmm. project?
Yeah.
Original constitutional language. Well, you know, he went to Oral Roberts University for his bachelor's. So that kind of his orientation was like that.
Mm-hmm. That does fill in some things. Do you miss ministry, or is your work as a social worker and as a teacher, does that sort of replace that for you?
A little bit. That the things I have pursued since I, you know, once the intensity of Gene Robinson subsided, Bishop Moody didn't know what to do with me. He had not the courage or the conviction or the energy, I think, is more like he was close to retiring, to even have a dialogue about me getting back into active ordained ministry. And then I do spoken word, and I was becoming involved in a Cathedral of Hope here in Oklahoma City, which at that time was a metropolitan community church, and then is now part of the UCC, United Church of Christ. I was getting involved with that, and one time was invited, asked to write a spoken word poem to perform about walking on water, that passage. And I vested in my alb because everybody who was part of the worship team vested there. And someone took pictures of me and a video of me doing it. It got published in an online magazine or online, and it got back to Bishop Moody. And without a discussion, he sent me a letter demanding my renunciation. And if I did not renounce, that he was going to take me in front of ecclesiastical trial on the charge of abandoning the communion. And I just really felt like, okay, so he took the first opportunity he could to get rid of me.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. That hurts my heart for you.
And I went ahead and renounced because I knew who the standing committee was. I was at some of these meetings where the standing committee, people on the standing committee were talking about their position with Gene Robinson. And I knew I had not a chance in an ecclesiastical trial. And after all the media attention I'd had from 2001 through 2005, I just did not, I didn't have the stomach for it anymore. I didn't want to be in this ecclesiastical trial and have the people who were leaking stuff about me to people like David Virtue. I just didn't, I didn't want that kind of scrutiny anymore. And I went ahead and renounced. Once I did, 2 years later, I guess I wanted to be an atheist. I tried to be. I couldn't stop believing. But, and then this, and even ever since then, I really don't know where I fit.
Even now?
I have a call to ministry. I still do.
Yeah.
That's never gone away. I mean, my call to ministry has been as present in my life since, and as powerful as my gender identity issues were, and inescapable, with nowhere to express it, no support, even in UCC churches here. I just worked on developing my writing and finding opportunities to teach. And at first I couldn't, but eventually I was able to, because I love teaching. Social work appealed to me because of the appeal for social justice, and the very roots of the social work profession are aligned with the values of the social gospel movement and, you know, in Christian socialism, which really is, that's where my theology aligns with, you know, so that, you know, cause like Jane Addams, who started, who started Hull House in Chicago and places like that, she was part of the social gospel movement. And I even knew that because while I was in my formation process, I did some research on the death penalty, and I had to write a paper approaching the death penalty from three theologies. I'm sorry. One, the Christian socialism or the social gospel, and then liberation theology and Christian conservatism, which I'm sure you all know that Christian conservatism isn't the same as dominionism. Christian conservatism is actually pretty liberal. It's more mainline Christianity than it is fundamentalist Christianity. But I analyzed the death penalty under those, I guess that was my thesis in a way, in my deacon formation. And during that process, I decided I had been pro-death penalty, and I realized that I couldn't support the death penalty anymore. And that's when I learned about Jane Addams and Reinhold Niebuhr, you know.
Yeah.
Serenity Prayer. He's attributed for having written that prayer, and he was a social gospel proponent. And then when I started learning about social work and seeing how that those traditions are, it appealed to me because of the emphasis on social justice. And as a police officer, I had a mind for justice, but the justice that law enforcement goes for is more on an individual responsibility, which is valid, but most police officers, they don't have any appreciation for systemic issues.
Right. Yep.
It's all personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then during my ministry formation process, I learned about the systemic issues via my study of the death penalty. I mean, I wrote a thesis long paper on that.
You're talking our language, Paula.
That's how I came into social work. Was because of that and that concern. So in a way, I'm still trying to express my ministry through my vocation. What I really loved was the preaching. And it's not just actually delivering the sermon. I loved going through the lectionary. I loved reading the passage and letting it germinate and letting the story speak to me, and then coming up with the way that I was going to deliver it and learning the story and then delivering it. And that whole theological reflection process, I really fell in love with that. And that's really what's missing for me, is that kind of an outlet, that kind of affirmation. But I'm not sure I could pass an examination to be ordained anymore, because I'm Christian in a perennial way. Through this process, I see, sincere people who are Buddhist and who are Muslim and who have other belief systems. And I cannot say that they're on a wrong path. I just don't judge that. And then I'm Christian in the sense that that's how I am oriented to the divine. And those stories, going back to Herbert's story of the Bible, I love those stories. Those stories taught me about a lot of things, even injustices,
And I know just what you mean. That's why I describe myself as religiously eclectic and spiritually fluid. I still identify primarily as a Christian, because that's the community that raised me. But I like to take from lots of different religious traditions, because there's so much, spirit feeding stuff that I like to get, spirit nurturing. Yeah. So.
Well, Paula, I hate to do this.
She's the one who cuts. Yes, you are. You're the one that's like, we got to go.
We could go for a much longer time. Totally enjoyed talking with you and hearing your story. And we are very excited to be able to share it.
So grateful that you came on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We would like to keep in touch with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you.
And we will definitely let you know before this launches too. But we just are so appreciative of you spending the time with us and sharing your story. I can relate to a lot of it, not from being trans, but from certainly being a woman and, in a church that I didn't fit in the box. So,
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.